They say that luck favors the prepared. But what about hard luck? Hard luck doesn't seem to care if you're ready or not. And you don't have to go looking for it. No, sometimes it'll come find you. Just ask Paul Eggert. Paul was born out in the country on a little farm, one of 13 children. His father was a man who did a lot more drinking than he ever did working. And as you might imagine, after 13 kids and an alcoholic husband, Paul's mom was just about at the end of her rope. As an adult, Paul would get by, just as so many other ordinary people do in this world. But back then, he was considered slow, feeble-minded. He dropped out of school before he was 10 years old. And even that held a dark secret, because while his brothers and sisters were at school, Paul went from farm to farm in the neighborhood, begging for the family's next meal. For days, then weeks, then months, the cycle continued. But one day, when Paul was 11, someone came in a car from the city. While his brothers and sisters were at school, Paul was transported to the hospital, placed under anesthesia, and when he woke up, he knew something had happened, but he had no idea what. Paul healed quickly and returned back to his miserable life, holding on to the dream that maybe someday he would be able to have a family of his own, and he would give them the love they needed. He would give them the time they deserved. But hard luck wasn't done with Paul just yet. Not just yet. Hard luck came to Helga when she was born, for she was born deaf, but it seemed that she might get away. Her father had a good job. They had the money to send her to a special school for the deaf, where she would be able to learn to communicate, learn sign language, learn to be a productive member of society. Her mother and father loved her and spent all the time and resources they could to help her overcome this rough start in her life. And by all accounts, she was doing well and living quite happily. Until one day, when she was 16, someone came to the door. They said that everyone who went to Helga's school would have to report to the hospital for sterilization. Helga was confused. She didn't understand what she had done or why this needed to happen to her. But the true weight of what happened wouldn't sit upon her for many years. Helga, like so many of her classmates, did as she was told, reported to the hospital for the surgery, and then returned to her seemingly normal life as though it was all just a bad dream, until one day years and years later when her sister had a beautiful baby girl, and she brought the girl home, and as Helga held this beautiful little child, it was then that she realized she would never have that opportunity. She would never be a mother. When Dorothea was born, it was as though Lady Luck herself smiled down upon the child. She too had parents who loved and adored her, who helped her. From the youngest age, Dorothea knew what she wanted to do and knew what she wanted to be. Dorothea wanted to be a wife. She wanted to be a mother, and she wanted to be a kindergarten teacher. Her teenage years seemed to seamlessly follow this path, courting young men, finishing her studies, preparing to enter the program to become a kindergarten teacher. Dorothea's plans, however, came crashing to a halt one day when she was 19 years old. She had what was determined to be a schizophrenic attack. She was taken to the hospital, and in those days, how to treat schizophrenia and other mental disorders was not well known. Her parents were told they could not be there beside her, and she had to endure many things which would seem like needless torture to us today. There, along with many other women that she was housed with in the mental hospital, she began to notice that many of these girls, older and younger, all had similar scars on their abdomens. When she asked the doctors what was going on, they assured her that it was just from appendectomies, as though everyone in the facility had appendicitis at the same time. In that cold and lonely hospital, with none of her family around, Dorothea received a tubal ligation. She, like all the other women on the ward, had been sterilized. And all of her dreams changed because she would never have a child. She would never be allowed to be married. And in the cruelest of ironies, she wouldn't even be allowed to teach kindergarten. Her dreams would change forever, as did those of Helga, who would never hold a baby of her own. And many years later, Paul would come to realize that that operation when he was 11 was a vasectomy, and he would never have his own family to hold and to love. Because long before Jews from all over Europe were crammed into cattle cars and taken to the ovens, years before cripples or the mentally ill were secretly put to death, the Nazis dipped their toe into the dark waters of genocide by creating their vision of the perfect future and sterilizing anything that didn't fit the mold. Welcome to History on the Dark Side. I'm your host, Jared Andrus, and every episode we dive deep into those historical subjects that are both fascinating and terrifying, with the goal of learning those things that can be learned so that we never forget those parts of history that sometimes we'd rather not remember. In this series on the Nazi doctors, we will be looking in depth at how the medical community in Nazi Germany was influenced by those political ideals, as well as helped to influence the shape and form of the ultimate genocide that we know as the Holocaust. Some of the descriptions will be graphic. The Nazis perpetrated real crimes. Real people died by the millions. Real pain was felt by all. Listener discretion is strongly advised. If you are uncomfortable with this kind of subject matter or intensity, I would invite you to check out my other podcast, History on the Bright Side. But if you are prepared, then let's begin to analyze this week's segment of the Nazi Doctors. Welcome to the Dark Side. Hello and welcome to History on the Dark Side. Today, I have a very special guest host. It's my daughter, Cadence Melodence Andrus.
Hi!
That's not a real name. And Katie, you are on the first video episode. So hello, YouTube. We're new here.
Hi, YouTube.
As we started thinking about how to do the podcast, I went with this big conglomeration of other teachers, and that was fun for stuff that we did in school. And then I decided to make it really serious, do the deep dive, and just be serious. And I decided that's not very fun. And I want to do the podcast. I do love history, but I wanted it to be fun, too. And you know what? You know what's fun for me, Katie?
Me. I'm pretty fun.
I was going to say the family, but yes, you are pretty fun. So yes, thank you. Now, our lovely viewers and listeners probably don't know that you recently had a little busy weekend. What were you up to, dear?
I competed in the speech and debate national qualifying tournament.
Oh, that sounds very nerdy, very nerdy. Now, our whole family's done speech and debate, so she's just one of many. However, it turns out she's the best of many. So tell us how you did.
I was undefeated and qualified to nationals.
Okay. Undefeated in which style of debate?
A public forum.
Okay, so that's not real debate. You keeping score at home, but it's debate light, and she still dominated. Good job.
Well, and I'm still the first in our family to qualify to nationals, so.
Well, I mean, you did go last year in Congress, too, so.
Don't mind me.
Anyways, the only reason I even bring that up is because when I debated 1987, 1988, 1989, something like that, many years ago, every debate, especially in policy, there was only two debates back then, ended because someone was going to cause a nuclear war or someone was being just like the Nazis.
Oh, yeah. As you can really see it if you get into Lincoln Douglas debate, too. Everyone gets compared to Hitler. Everyone.
There you go. So in 20 or 30 or more years of debate in high school, we haven't gotten past, oh, you're just as bad as Hitler.
Who else is going to keep the legends alive?
Keep the legends alive?
Maybe poor word choice.
So one thing that matters to me in history is, since everybody talks about Hitler and we see it all the time, every time anybody ever said anything about the Trump impeachment version one or two, we were there for both. We weren't there, but he's always Hitler and his people are always jackbooted thugs. And when Antifa and our Black Lives Matter or anybody else was protesting or rioting throughout the summer, they were always just like Hitler and the Nazis. Everybody's always the Nazis. So one thing I wanted to do is talk about what really happened with the Nazis. They get bantered about all the time. And most people who use this kind of visualization or use this kind of talk about what the Nazis were, they weren't there and they haven't really studied much. They just know that Nazis is kind of the ultimate trigger word for something really bad or evil. Sound fair?
Yeah.
I mean, you kids today, what do you know about Nazis?
That they were really bad and evil.
There's my point. So when we talk about where things began with the Nazis, one thing that really kind of matters most is Hitler talked about having the Third Reich, the third 1,000 years of German excellence. He meant that. Like, we're in America.
Yeah.
We don't have 1,000 years of memory. Our country's like, what, 250? We're two something? We're a little baby country. So when you get to Europe, or heaven forbid you talk China, you know, once you get outside of America, there's places that actually have really long histories. I guess there were some people in America that had 1,000-year histories.
But for America as a nation, definitely not.
Right. Those would be like the native tribes that we just kind of steamrolled and buried their history.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. And it was unwritten history for the most part, so that made it weird too. But in Germany, they've got this idea of Volk. It's spelled more like Volk. So if I say Volk, what do you think of, Katie Bell?
A Volkswagen.
Yeah, there you go. Everybody can think of the Volkswagen. And if you're my generation, you think of the Beetle. If you're your generation, maybe think of Jetta or something. I don't know.
Think of a van.
Okay.
Like the hippie 70s van.
All right, so that's fair. That vehicle, you know, the Volkswagen is the people's wagon, the people's vehicle. But this idea of Volk goes not just meaning people in the way we would think of it, like a crowd, or even like a nationality. Like, I'm rah-rah, go Team America. I'm all for it, right? America, yeah, we're great. Glad I'm American. But this idea of Volk has a very kind of militaristic aspect to it. If you look at the definition, it's actually kind of a big group, like you're preparing for a battle or a war or something. Now, I don't know what you know about ancient Germanic military history.
Literally nothing.
Okay. But you probably do and you just don't know. Okay. When Rome fell and it was all of the Vandals and the Visigoths and all these barbarians at the gate, right?
Yeah.
So outside of the Huns who came through and wiped out everybody, all those other groups of people are basically Germanic tribes that had come down from the north and just raised holy terror. Like when Caesar and the other great leaders in Rome were getting powerful, they made it into England, they make it through France. They kind of don't make it all the way up into what is modern day Germany. Because those people are just done crazy. They fight better, and they're able to withstand this Roman occupation and this Roman domination that most of the rest of Europe fell under. So there's this really proud history that the Germanic people can look back to. And it's real. It's real history. At the time, Hitler comes to power. Mussolini, he's already come to power in Italy before that. Now, Italy can look back to some pretty awesome previous times too, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Rome, thank you. And Mussolini's trying to play on that and get people in Italy to look at, hey, we're this people still. Whatever happened and along the way, the last couple thousand years got a little sideways, but that's us. At our heart, at our core, we're those people. And one of the things Hitler does when he comes to power is he really embraces this concept of Volk, of looking back in German history, but it's not something he created. Like, this is going on around him. He just jumps on it and is like, yes, thank you very much. Volk rocks, which sounds like a cool rock band might be playing at the local auditorium soon. I don't know. Volk rock! Anyway, if you like the German death metal music, I imagine there probably is a band. They'll probably sue me for bringing up their name on the air, or they'll pay me. Either way, I guess I'll find out. So as they go into this concept of Volk, of looking backwards, of having this proud, successful, militaristic history, they can not only look back, but they can look ahead and imagine what hundreds of years or thousands of years in the future might be. Like, there's something about having thousands of years of history enables you to look forward in a way that maybe we can't do here in America. Like, if I'm gonna look into my future American crystal ball, if I want to look 2 years, can you get me there? 2 years.
I mean,
what's going to happen in America in 2 years? Go.
We'll probably have the strongest military still.
We're like that. Thank you.
There will be some sort of economics going on. Could be either a crash or a rise. Either way, we'll survive.
Okay.
That's kind of all I got.
All right.
I mean, that's just what our history has been.
There'll probably be some Super Bowls still. We'll, carry on, like you say. But now, if we're going to project that out, give me 100 years in the future in America.
A whole lot can change in 100 years.
I mean, I feel like we get to the point where we go, well, if we're going to look ahead 100 years, are we even still here? Does it still look at all like it does politically? Are we 50 states? Has that all changed? Has the world changed? Are we is China now the superpower and we're some second or third tier type person? I mean, we've been on top for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue probably as early as maybe the Spanish-American War,
yeah,
when we took over the Philippines and all that. But certainly by the end of World War I, we're the big dog. And we have stayed up there ever since. But man, it's a little different. There's a lot of people closing in on us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to look forward because we don't have hundreds and hundreds of years of the past to judge that on.
To project it.
Right. But in Germany, you do. You've got that. You've got long-standing traditions. You've got symbolism. You've got, you know, the Norse gods and Norse mythology. You've got a lot of things that you can hearken back to. That, I mean, we can go back to like 1776. What we got? We got the Sons of Liberty dumping the tea, and that's cool. That's fun.
A couple massacres, but. No.
And we try and play those down.
Yeah. Like, not necessarily proud of those.
Hopefully not, but yeah. So here's this German people, and we've got to talk about what is the world Hitler comes to power in. So he's preaching, hey, we used to be the bomb, and we used to be the superpower, and we can be again. Where do you feel like that becomes most appealing to a country?
I mean, I feel like when you're, especially in Hitler's position where he's trying to come to power in this instance, like in order for him to have followers, he has to appeal to them in some way. And probably the most obvious way is through fear, but he has to find a way to instill fear in each of those people, which is a pretty broad spectrum.
Okay. And we often think of Hitler as this fear monger, right?
But at the same time, he was a really efficient recruiter.
Well, he inspired people. And he didn't inspire them because he told them anything new or different. He told them stuff that they were hearing all around them. in a little more forceful, a little more dramatic way, which is very typical of, you know, if we had somebody who was given a speech in politics and was just up and down and screaming, and I mean, Hitler's all over the place. It looks a little foreign to us. It's like a little too much. Like, what's this guy doing? But that's very appealing to kind of their tradition, this demonstrative way of speaking. But he's harnessing ideas that are already all around him. One thing about Hitler, okay? He does not create a lot of original thought. He just doesn't. But what he's good at is being a spokesman for things that are already out there. And maybe the spokesmen that exist aren't that great. But before anybody hates the Jews or hates anything else, or even before they hate France, he finds this kernel of, let's love Germany. Not the one we're in now, because post-World War I Germany sucked.
Little rough.
Like the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I basically guaranteed World War II. Now, everybody in Germany is just like, oh, we did not even lose the war. When the war ends, they're still on foreign soil. The war hasn't even come to Germany. And so it seems like that would be easy to think about, oh, well, we didn't lose. Nothing happened here. Like, for your generation, mine too, maybe. Is it hard to imagine that we, America, lost the Vietnam War?
Yeah, especially seeing our hegemony right now with, like, our military. The concept of losing a war is so foreign. It's so very foreign. And I've even heard many people in my generation talk about the Vietnam War and get it wrong. And they talk about, you know, how we win. I'm like, no, wait, we most definitely, that was a war that we'd most definitely lost.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's just so absolutely foreign because of how strong we are now.
And, you know, for thousands of years, you lose a war when the enemy occupies you. They take you over. You're clearly the loser at that point. But here we have Germany that's done all the fighting in France, a little bit in Russia, but they've been all up and down France. It sucks for France. The death tolls are staggering. And then as the war comes to more of a conclusion, as the Americans come on board, Germany's bled out. They've thrown all the soldiers they can at this thing. And even with Russia having their revolution and bailing on the war and moving everybody from the east to the west, there's not enough. They can't sustain victory because in that style of war, it's really just a meat grinder. Whoever's got the most people is going to win. And here comes the Americans, and that tips the balance. And they're retreating, and they're getting pushed back across France. And, you know, the leaders realize we're done. They can keep sending people. We can't do anything. Mm-hmm. So let's call it, because if we call it now, while we're still out there, it's going to be better than if we wait until they're in Berlin. Nobody wants that. And that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they have this negotiation for, okay, we're going to end the war. And it doesn't work out for them because we're there with Woodrow Wilson, who is not my favorite president. He's a wee little bit of a racist and way too... out of my comfort level and a lot of social ideas. But he's there saying, hey, let's have a peace without casting blame. Like, the whole world was nuts. They were all excited and happy to have this war. Everybody was cheering and, yes, we're going to go and we're going to win and it's going to be great. And it wasn't great. It was terrible.
I mean, it's a war. What part of it is great?
It was one of the worst ones ever because you're just lining up people and they're killing each other because the weapons are so much more advanced than defensive or tactical things. Until tanks and airplanes, it's really just a meat grinder.
And it is a world war, and everyone was involved in it.
Right.
So it's not really like blame can be cast to any one country, because guess what? Everyone participated.
Great. See, thinking like yours prevents Nazis. Good job, Katie. However, that's not the thinking that won over the day in France, especially. France is really bitter. They should be. Most of that bleeding happened on their soil. 1 in 7 Frenchmen die. 1 in 7.
Pretty big number.
That's basically, and they've got decent sized families over there. So basically everybody lost somebody in that war. Germany lost a whole generation of people too. They lost a lot.
And so did all, you know, the other England and the other countries involved. It's bad all the way around. But France is super mad, because wars always meant, well, we win, then we get it back, and the soldiers go, and then we get them back. Do you want to just walk over there and the light will come back on? That's one of the fun parts of auto lights. Yeah, that was great.
We're back.
And so France is so mad, and they just say, hey, Germany's got to pay for this war. They're going to lose a bunch of their land. They're going to lose all their military. They're going to have to pay gazillions of dollars. And so when you have a bill for a gazillion dollars, there's a couple ways you can try and get out of debt. What do you think, Katie? I have a bill for a gazillion dollars and I'm a country. What can I do?
Industrial revolutions.
Okay.
Production, amp up production and exports.
We could build our way out. That would have been a novel approach. It would have been difficult, but that's not where Germany went, which is a little shocking. They're one of the better industrializing mindset and physical countries on Earth, historically. But they, and this is just crazy, right? Like France says, you got to pay this debt in Reichsmark. You owe us blank amount of your dollars. Okay? So I'm Germany. I want the loophole. What do I do?
Well, if it's of my money.
And I'm a country.
My money's different than your money.
Yeah.
Then I'm totally going to cheat that out and be like, I paid you however much of my money, even if it's only $2.
No, you're just the opposite. They just printed more money. They're like, oh, we owe you 50 trillion Reichsmarks.
Oh, okay.
Sweet. Start the presses. Chop down some trees.
Get to printing. Put everyone in
poverty. Totally. Superinflation, hyperinflation. The stuff going on in Venezuela.
With 1,000,000% inflation.
Yeah, that's what happens. People are literally, and there's photos and some old history books, people are wheelbarrowing money to the store to buy a loaf of bread because it costs like, who knows, 100,000 Reichmarks. Now, that's great if you're trying to pay off the debt. Here's all your money, but you totally destroyed your own population. Now, this is all pre-Hitler. Hitler was in the war. He didn't play any grand part. He comes back, and he's living in this general kind of atmosphere. I don't know if it's any better or worse for him. He's Austrian, so he bounces around, you know, Germanic people, which I guess is another part of this whole Volk idea. Like, when we think of American people, you can follow the trail a couple places. England, France, or Native Americans. That's really it, right?
Maybe a little bit of Spanish, but...
And if you're going to follow England or France or Spain, you can only do that from, like, 1495 on. And then maybe there's some Vikings before that up in Newfoundland. So the trail's kind of different. But there's these Germanic people that have similar customs, similar religions, similar languages, all around that region of Europe. Germany's one of the last countries to unify. And the day they did, they're probably the strongest country in Europe. Europe spent its entire existence trying to fight this from happening, keep them from unifying. Who did the English hire to help them in the Revolutionary War against the wannabe Americans?
They hired Germans.
Yeah, the Hessians are all German.
Yeah, they hired German like ambassadors and stuff to just go kill everybody.
Right. So they've got this military tradition, and it's proud. And all over Europe and other places, they're hiring Germanic groups from one region or another. But when you hire them out to do your bidding, not only does it help you as another country, but it keeps them from getting together. So there's been this big double layer of things going on. Now, the other big area besides like the fall of Rome thing that Germany can look back on, their second, you know, 1,000 years, the Second Reich, is the Holy Roman Empire. So after the fall of Rome, and then we get into the Dark Ages, and as we're coming out of that, you've got this kind of secondary burst of the Roman Empire as a Christian empire, Charlemagne, all that kind of thing, right? That's primarily Germanic people too. So they've got a couple cool things to look back on. And now Hitler's like, we need to look ahead. And we need to look ahead for 1,000 years. People buy that. They are willing to take that long-term view. How does that change your worldview if you're looking that far in advance?
It changes it a lot, because it's like in 1,000 years, I'm not even living there for that world that I'm trying to change right now.
Right.
So I can imagine what it looks like, and I can try to, you know, get it there, but I'll never even know if it does.
But But let's take it back. You're, how old are you?
I'm 17.
She's 17. I know she was born in February. Don't ask me the day. Anyway, I ask her when the kids' birthdays are. It's a little sad. So you want to have a family someday, right?
Yeah.
You want to have kids? Yeah. Grandkids maybe someday?
Yeah, I love little kids.
Are there things you're willing to do differently now?
Oh,
because
sure.
You think it might have an impact on your future kids or grandkids.
Oh, for sure. Like,